Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
And they're off in the Kentucky Derby. American Lion SB, there goes Conveyance. He's looking for speed on the outside.
Say horse track, racing, and most Americans think Triple Crown stuff, Kentucky Derby, the Preakness, fancy. But there's another, scrappier side to horse racing, dusty little tracks with all kinds of stories. Novelist Jamie Gordon has just spun that world into a National Book Award. It's a world she's lived. This hour, On Point Horse, Track, Jamie Gordon and her big winner, Lord of Misrule. You can join the conversation. Do you know this world, the scrappy side of racing, the stables, the characters, the horses? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we will hear from Bill Knack, author of the 1975 bestseller Secretariat, now out from Hollywood. But first, joining me from Kalamazoo, Michigan, is Jamie Gordon. She's taught creative writing at Western Michigan University since 1981. She's written From the Edges, published Small and True, and now has walked away with a delightful dark horse win of the 2010 National Book Award for Lord of Misrule. Jamie Gordon, congratulations. It's great to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Hi. We're really glad you're here and really looking forward to talking about this. I mean, you said when they announced your name at the big, hoity-toity festival in New York, I'm totally unprepared. I'm totally surprised. Why?
Well, even though I think I wrote a good book, mm-hmm. It was up against the American healthcare system. Alexei de Tocqueville, a commentator on the revolutionary period and just after, and Asian American immigration of the last 100 years. And I was writing about a dinky racetrack that never existed on the Ohio River in West Virginia. I just didn't think that I was going to have the weight. Right. I was absolutely positive that I wasn't going to have the weight. I was, what's more, because I was coming from a small press and I was not exactly a household name, I was sure that the judges would feel they had already done me a tremendous favor by making me a finalist. Already my career had changed substantially overnight. So I was just having a good time. I heard that people yeah. were creating their acceptance speeches and buying new gowns, and I just gathered as many people from my family as I could get to come with me, and we occupied a table, and my friend Salvatore Scibona from the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown was there to lend me moral support and drink with me if necessary. But I certainly never thought I was going to be walking up there to accept any trophies.
You were up against some pretty big competition, and you took the win, and it was, I think everybody was delighted by it. Remind us just how small your press is. What was the first run on Lord of Misrule? 2,000, 8,000 something?
I think that that Bruce was going to be, he was going to really go for broke and print 2,000 copies for sure. and when the book became a finalist and the pressure was on to go up from that, he whispered to me, I really like having pretty books, and I would have to sacrifice my embossed end papers if I went to 8,000.
Right.
But I think when he told his plan. Well, actually,
this is
the
Bruce McPherson, McPherson and Company. Very small press in Kingston, New York.
That's right. He's said in the press to have one employee himself, but I think he's going to up that so that he doesn't have to answer that question yes anymore.
Right.
Are you it?
Right. Hire one more so it's not just one. Jamie Gordon, what do you know about horses and how? What's your background there?
I was never one of those teenage girls who buys jodhpurs and a riding crop and takes riding lessons. Mm-hmm. But all animals interest me a lot. But I can't say I really ever had intimate knowledge of a horse until I was living in the Harpers Ferry, Charlestown, Winchester area of Virginia, West Virginia, Maryland. And I didn't have a job when I got there. And I worked in the three local industries that I was suited for. I worked briefly in a prison. Didn't like that very much. Mm. And I don't think they liked me either. And I worked for the newspaper, the Frederick News Post.
Yep.
And then I met a young horse trainer who was quite charismatic and knew how to round up young women to work for him for nothing on that racetrack. So I was still writing food copy for the Frederick News Post when I found myself walking hots for him after races and in the morning. And it's a very, very addicting world. And not one that really admits of too many other interests when it's underway, because it's all day long, starting from very early in the morning, and you're keeping different hours from most other human beings and lives of other creatures depend on you. And pretty soon you forget all about everything except the racetrack, or at least I did for 3 years.
Including some pretty big, beautiful animals, those horses you're working with. I want to be sure to get Lord of Misrule in here. And we've got a little reading from the book where Maggie Kutterer, the sort of hot young thing, speaking of walking hots, we'll talk about all that great lingo. But she's with the horse Pelter. And in a young fool of a boyfriend, as you write it, Tommy Hansel, working on that horse. There's a great description of just the beauty of the animal and the interaction. I wonder if you could read a little bit for us, Jamie, from Lord of Misrule.
With pleasure. Why did she so love the slant-eyed, bump-nosed horse that her hands wished to parse every inch of his famously long back? It was true she had no scientific reason to believe she knew what she was doing, but surreptitiously she did think so. For all her stamina, as a human girl, she knew she was lazy and unambitious, except for this one thing. She could find her way to the boundary where she ended and some other strain of living creature began. On the last little spit of being human, staring through rags of fog into the not human, where you weren't supposed to be able to see, let alone cross, she could make a kind of home. Her hands felt their way blindly along the ridges and canyons and defiles of the spine, the firm, root-spread hillocks of the withers. She rolled her bony knuckles all along the fallen tree of scar tissue at the crest of the back, prying up its branches, loosening its teeth. And it must be having some effect. When she walked Pelter these days, he wasn't the sour fellow he used to be. He was sportive, even funny. She had walked him this morning until the rising sun snagged in the hackberry thicket. As they swung around the barn, she took a carrot from her pocket and gave him the butt and noisily toothed the good half herself. He curveted like a colt, squealed and cow-kicked alarmingly near her groin. "Okay, okay," she said, and handed it over. She was glad there was no man around just then to tell her to show that horse who was boss. When they were back in the stall and she turned to leave, she found he had taken her whole raincoat in his mouth and was chewing it, the one she was wearing. She twisted around with difficulty and pried it out of his mouth. He eyed her ironically. "Just between us, is this the sort of horse act I really ought to discipline?" she asked him, smoothing out her coat. "I simply incline to your company," he replied.
As if, the horse replied. Jimmy Gordon there reading from Lord of Misrule. What is it about horses? I mean, here you've got your character Maggie with that wonderful staring through rags of fog into the not human and feeling she has the capacity to do that. What is it about horses that draw humans? I don't know. Sometimes in particular women, I don't know, to cross that chasm And then you've got a very different view of horses in here as well, of guys who just see them as maybe some money and good luck to them.
Well, I do think that some men appreciate horses just the the same way that at least some women do. Mm-hmm. First of all, they're big. It's wonderful to feel that you trust and have come intimately to know an animal that big and beautiful. I remember when I was first told that I didn't have to worry about my cat walking around in the stall with the horse because he knew perfectly well where she was, mm-hmm. and he wouldn't step on her for the world unless he felt like it. Apart from their intelligence about where all parts of their body are, mm-hmm. racehorses are, even the ones that are not the most successful, are incredibly brave compared to a lot of other animals. That's what they've been bred to do. They've been bred to run. They've been bred to race. And seeing them race is, for me, still to this day, an incredibly moving experience. I mean, I especially love it when an animal is coming from off the pace and charging to the front of the mm-hmm. of the pack of racehorses one way or another. But even when it's not that, even when I'm just standing by the rail and horses go by, I invariably feel moved in some way. I love the way the ground is shaking.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about life at the track, about horse racing, with 2010 National Book Award winner Jamie Gordon. Her prize-winning novel of horse and track is Lord of Misrule, and we're going to dive right in. There's the fancy side, the not-so-fancy side. On the Triple Crown side, here's the start of the 2010 Belmont Stakes.
And they're off. Interactive on the far outside. Spangled Star is there. First Dude has some speed, so does Game On Dude. So they make their way to that sweeping clubhouse turn here at Belmont Park, and it's First Dude who's first into the turn. Uptown Charlie Brown is up close to the pace today, and Interactive is too. He's right there running in third.
First Dude, first into the turn and on the go at Belmont Stakes. Jamie Gordon is writing about a much more sort of down and dirty, dusty world of horse track racing. Jamie Gordon joins us from Kalamazoo, Michigan. Let's go right to our listeners. Valerie in Watertown, Massachusetts. Valerie, you're on the air with Jamie Gordon.
Yes, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. It's really great to hear about this side of racing. I was living in Philadelphia with my grandmother after I graduated from college, and I'm 55 now, so mm-hmm. I was in my early 20s, and I had always wanted to work with horses, and I heard from somebody that if I showed up at the track, which was Keystone Racetrack then, some crazy early time, like 5:30 in the morning, the stable owners would come by and they would choose somebody to work for the day, so sort of a day laborer. And so I went, and of course I was chosen, and I wound up hot walking, being a hot walker, and also just working in the stables. And when the outfit went down to Atlantic City, at the time I was working just during the day, and then when they went to Atlantic City, I went and I lived above the stables. And it was quite an amazing experience. Track people are pretty marginal types, at least they were when I was there. I don't know if it's changed that much, but I went and I lived on the track with my cat above the stable. And
sounds like you liked it. What did you like about it, Valerie, exactly?
Well, I loved, I did really love watching the horses run. They're amazing animals. When you're in the stable, and when you're in the stalls working with them, they're huge. I mean, they're these huge horses. And I have always loved horses, but like the author, I was never one of those girls who was able to take lessons and do all that stuff, but I've just always loved them. The one thing I did notice, though, when I was on the track was there's a cruelty. I felt like there was a lot of cruelty that went on when dealing with the horses. I mean, making them run because they had to make money from them. So pushing them to run when they were injured, you know, giving them lots of medication so they would run despite their injuries. And so that was a side of it that was that I didn't like.
Not so gorgeous. Valerie, Jamie Gordon is very honed in on that, and we're going to look at all of that. There's the love the horse side. There's the cruel side as well. I'll take it to Jamie. Let me get one more call from Horse Country in Kentucky first, Lexington, Kentucky. Kathleen, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and hello, Jamie. I wanted to make the point that I thought your reading was right on. I'm a former journalist who has covered horse racing. I've interviewed Bill Knack, and the point you made about having a horse suck your coat, I've had them suck the zippers off my coat because I've worked on the racetrack as well. And also your point about men who insist that you show the horse who's boss, although that seems kind of silly because we know they can kill you with one kick if they want to, right?
Right.
And I wanted to say that I have a retired racehorse. I adopted a horse from the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. And the past 48 hours, I've been nursing him through colic.
Oh, boy.
So it's not very glamorous.
Kathleen, you know it up close and personal, and I love that as well. Jamie, there's a lot for us to feast on here. Maybe the place to start, just because we've come in with sound of all these triple count crown kind of fanfare settings, is for you, if you would, just to kind of paint a picture of your horse track, the fictional Indian Mound Downs. This is not like Pimlico, which you grew up next to, or Belmont. Give us a little picture of this track. What kind of track is this? How common is this? What's it look like? How does it feel compared to those grand scenes we see on the annual big races?
I have to admit that if anyone looks closely, even at the cover, that is the wraparound cover of my novel, if it's a race tracker who's looking, he or she is going to know this is not Indian Mound Downs.
This is not a down at the heels.
Presentable.
Right. It looks pretty
well
groomed.
It's far too beautiful.
Yeah,
it's far too well kept in every way. It's even too big. That is the splendor of the setting.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't have that cramped feeling.
So take us to yours, your fictional arena or track. What's it look like? What's it feel like?
Well, if there starts to be a kind of moat around the edge of the stall, it's going to stay that way for a long time. That is one of the first things you might find yourself doing is shoveling dirt to try to get the floor of the stall to be halfway habitable by a horse. At the racetracks that I worked on, if your horse was feeling fractious, there might not be a stall 5 minutes later. That is, the planking might fall down.
A little kicking and the stall gone, right?
That's right. There were some funny incidents, some not so funny, when horses were staring right at each other to their own surprise because there wasn't a wall between them anymore. I have to say that I think that a lot of the basic layout of the backside, as I always called it, some people say the backstretch, the backside of the tracks that I worked on was probably not in its essence that different. There still have to be shed rows, that is rows of stalls that are built into a kind of barn, and there's a dirt track that runs all the way around them. So on a cheap track where a lot of the horses are sore, as the caller mentioned, they're running sore, but they're not training very much anymore. They're rarely asked not asked anymore to go to the track every morning and run. That would do them in. So they might be coming out every 10 days, every 2 weeks, sometimes even once a week to run. And the rest of the time, they just walk. They just they walk for exercise in the morning for half an hour, were a comparable amount of time.
And it's not glamorous. Like, it's not beautiful green fields. It's not beautiful green paddock there.
It's not glamorous. They may, for months or even years, never see a meadow or a farm, especially, I mean, some of the cheap tracks specialize in running all year, in being open when no other track would be. That's not necessarily a feature of a cheap track, but in my day it was. That, in fact, was one of the assets of those Charlestown Shenandoah Downs tracks that I worked on when I was in my 20s. That if you were habitual better, if you had to go to the track, that was one place you could go, even in January.
You describe, of course, we're in the off season here now, but they'd keep it running there. You describe a moment where the sort of the horse in the title of your book, Lord of Misrule, and what great names they have in racing, comes out of the truck. And this is a horse with quite a reputation. Everybody at even down and out Indian Mound Downs is excited to see him come. But we pretty quickly get by the sort of glamour, you know, horsey set vision of the world here as this fabled horse is delivered, arrives. I wonder if you'd read a bit of that from Lord of Misrule for us, Jamie.
Gladly. They were all looking for a van like a Chinese jewel box, like no horse van that had ever been seen on a backside, something red and black and glossy, with gold letters, Lord of Misrule, arched across each side. All the same, when a plain truck with Nebraska plates rolled into the mound on the hottest day of the year, they knew who it was. They were watching, though the van was unmarked and dirty white, one of those big box trailers with rusty quilting like an old mattress pad you've given to the dog. The van bounced and groaned on its springs along the backside fence, headed for the stallman's office. Red dust boiled around it. They blinked as it dragged two wheels through the puddle that never dried, the puddle that had no bottom. They all waited for the van to tilt and lurch to a stop. It didn't even slow down. They peered through the vents when the van went by and saw the horse's head, calm, black, and poisonous of mien as a slag pile in a coal yard. He had a funny white stripe like a question mark on his forehead. The van stopped. Woof, down comes the ramp, and a kid, unhealthy-looking like all racetrack kids, worm white, skull bones poking out of his skinny head, stood at the top of the ramp with a small black horse that couldn't even stand right. Lord of Misrule already rocked, or seemed to rock, on the flat floor of the van like a table with one short leg. And those legs. They were so swelled out from long-ago bowed tendons on both sides that they were one straight line from knee to ankle, drain pipes without contour, except for the waffling left over from firing and blistering agents, and God knows what.
And God knows what. Jamie Gordon reading from 2010 National Book Award winning novel, Lord of Misrule. And we've got the worm white, unhealthy looking racetrack kid, like all racetrack kids, you write in the. This is not the sort of beautiful, svelte young horse here. This is a horse that's been worked hard and being brought into a pretty dusty scene. Jamie Gordon joins us from Kalamazoo, Michigan, and we are really happy to have right now with us as well from Washington, Bill Knack, award-winning journalist and author, spent decades writing for Sports Illustrated, covered Secretariat's journey to the Triple Crown in 1973 as turf rider for Newsday. He's author of Secretariat, The Making of a Champion, came out some decades ago. The 2010 Disney movie Secretariat is based on his book. He consulted on the film, got a cameo there. Bill Knack, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, how you doing?
We're doing great. What do you think of the vision that Jamie Gordon is now famously bringing to us, not of that sort of fancy, you know, all the flashing colors and trumpets horse world, but just kind of down and deedy, dirty, seedy side of horse racing? How big a portion of racing is that, Bill?
Well, I think it probably is a large part on the bush track circuit. There's a lot of smaller tracks where I'm sure horses of that Jamie's writing about are very plentiful. I, in fact, have been on some of those racetracks, and I say it's a vivid, memorable vision of a part of racetrack life that has not been written about. But I'm glad she's brought it into a novel form. It's a wonderful book. I'm sitting here reading it now. A friend of mine sent it to me, and I received it yesterday, and I've just started reading it, and I'm up to about page 57, so it's terrific.
Well, you've got enough there to know. You're reading about her fictional Indian Mound Downs. Describe for us what a long way it is from that kind of little dusty half-mile trek in West Virginia to the top of the Triple Crown venues, Bill.
Well, that's what I'm more familiar with. When I was a kid, I worked on racetracks like Arlington Park and Washington Park outside of Chicago. And horses in those days were much sounder than they are now.
Why is that?
Well, it has to do with pedigree. It has to do with the fact that horses are just not as durable and as sound as they used to be. And it all goes back to genetics. They're just not as sound.
Too much inbreeding of winning lines or what?
Well, unfortunately, the fastest male lines in the world are the least sound. And a lot of it stems, in my opinion, from Native Dancer, who was not a sound racehorse. Started two or three times as a four-year-old, and one was almost undefeated. He did not win the Kentucky Derby. That was the only race he did not win. But when he went off to stud, he sired horses that were unsound, like Raisin Native, who sired Mr. Prospector. Mm-hmm. And both of those horses had very few starts. They were not sound. And whether it's bone density or what, but horses from these sire lines, and they're prolific now, do not run as are not as durable as the older lines like the Nasrullah line or Mahmood or some of the old sire lines that were dominant in the 30s and 40s and 50s in America.
We've got great horse people, Bill Knack and Jamie Gordon, great writers as well, with us as well. Phil in Boston, you're on the air, Phil.
Okay. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
This is a great, great segment. My dad used to own racehorses. I grew up 43. I grew up with them. I was at the nice tracks like Gulfstream Park in Belmont and the not-so-nice tracks like Suffolk Downs, where he rode most of his horses. There's definitely two sides to it. I empathize with the people that say it's cruel that they have them on medicine to keep them running, and then there's that other exciting side of watching them gallop. They're intelligent horses. I've been with different trainers and different jockeys that he's used over the years, from Julie Crone, and I've seen Cigar Run, and I just am excited to go out and buy this book.
You say it's bittersweet. We get the sweet part. Yeah. We all see that. The sort of nice, beautiful photos. What's the bitter part?
Well, the bitter part is watching horses run on these tracks that are not so nice. It was circuit through Massachusetts. There were fairs. They used to run these horses that were older. They weren't in good condition. The tracks were really poor. And they ran these horses just right into the ground. I mean, so many accidents. And even now to see horses run in these races, these Triple Crown races, when they're 2 years old and they're not fully developed and they're... you get scared. I get scared to see these horses run because I know, being working in the track with, you know, as a hot trot walker a couple times, that they're beautiful animals. But it's really, I feel there's a certain level of cruelty. I used to tell my father that all the time. So getting this book is going to be great because I know he loves all the Secretariat books and all the other movies that come out about it.
Phil, I appreciate your call. Our time is short before the break. Jamie Gordon, you've got a real finger feel for this tough side. I mean, that's what you're bringing us here in Lord of Misrule, this tough side of what can look pretty darn glamorous in the movies.
Well, maybe the side of racing that I'm writing about isn't glamorous, but I don't want anybody to think that my book is a brief for stopping cheap horse racing or any other kind of horse racing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you live in the Harper's Ferry corner of West Virginia, or, I mean, by now that's a kind of a bedroom community for Washington, D.C.,
mm-hmm.
but when I lived there, it was still out in the country. If you're addicted to horse racing, where else are you going to go? And if you've got to see horse racing, then you'll go to a cheap track.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about life at the track, about horse racing, with 2010 National Book Award winner Jamie Gordon. Her prize-winning novel of horse and track is Lord of Misrule, and it's getting rave reviews and the big prize. She joins us today from Kalamazoo, Michigan. Bill Nack is here as well, author of Secretariat, The Making of a Champion. It's the story everybody knows and the book behind the big Disney movie this year, Secretariat. Jamie, Bill, huge response here. Miranda writes at the website, she says, I've worked at Barn 10, at Churchill, and at Pimlico, and Gulfstream, but mostly, she writes, I worked at small tracks like Ellis and Turfway, where racing is a family business. It's a lot of hard work for very little tangible reward, 16-hour days, 7 days a week to barely make ends meet in most cases. There's a saying on the back side, she writes, that racing is everything life has to offer, from the sublime to the ridiculous. I hope, she writes, that more people get to experience it. And one more, Louisville, Kentucky, Jerry. You're on the air, Jerry.
Hey, how are you going?
Pretty well. What do you know, Jerry?
Well, not too much. It's cold over here in Kentucky today, but I was listening to your radio station, and I worked on a track over in Churchill, Ellis Park, too, and River Downs and different places like that. And I just got to say that I see good and bad and everything. It just the horse race industry, just a certain breed of people, and that's all they do, and most people don't understand the ins and outs behind and the backside. I love the industry myself, and the horses, and everything that goes along with it. Only bad side I see to it, personally, is the politicians, you know, the politics of horse racing. For example, Wool Emblem in 2003 should have been a Triple Crown winner, but up there in Belmont, up in New York, as soon as he hit the gate, they broke on him and he made him fall. The horse still coming in fourth. And sometimes I just don't understand, you know, how can they get away with stuff like that. But other than that, it's a pretty good industry. It keeps a lot of people floating.
Jerry, we love your voice and your experience right here, and I really appreciate your call. Well, look at those politics, that kind of track politics coming to Jamie Gordon's book as well in Lord of Misrule. Jamie, you were talking earlier, and Bill Nack was talking about the breeding of racehorses. I mean, there's a caller talking about track folks just being as our caller Jerry puts it, just a different breed of people. How do you describe or think about the strands of the track community, Jamie, the folks, you know, backtrack behind?
In my experience, racetrack people were, there were certainly hard-hearted people on the racetrack, but most of my everyday acquaintance on the racetrack was with people who were just my style, not too moralistic, willing to put up with hard weather, long hours, basically humane to horses, with some real understanding of what it takes for a human being to tune in an animal that's not made exactly like you.
Mm-hmm.
And fun to be around. That one of the great things about the racetrack, I wonder if this is still true. I mean, I haven't worked on a racetrack for years now, but televisions were every place already in the outside world when I was on the racetrack. And yet, there was rarely a TV to be seen on the backside. And what did people do instead? They told stories.
Mm-hmm.
They told the same kind of yarns over and over again, but one never got sick of them, really. Stories of how one gambled with a horse, meaning how one made a horse look a little less good on paper than he would actually be when he ran on the racetrack. I don't think anybody on the racetrack considers that scamming or criminal, by the way. It's just part of the game.
Mm-hmm.
What the results of that were. I mean, it's no accident that the expression, it is horse racing, means, well, you never know exactly how things are going to work out.
And what about what our caller Jerry in Louisville calls the politics? And I don't know if he means, you know, fixing, tilting races, bad calls about what's going on. You've got some of that written into Lord of Misrule. The sort of, I'm not sure a scam is the right way to put it, but things get pretty close out there.
I'd love to hear what Bill Nack has to say about it.
Well,
But I'll just answer quickly.
Yeah.
I do consider it part of the game. Some of it a little more upsetting than others. But I don't know if it's even politics. Sometimes I think jockeys kind of agree tacitly among each other to give one among them, maybe a younger one, a little bit of help. Is that evil? Is that politics? I'm not sure, but it's deeply part of the game.
Let's see what Mr. Knack thinks. Yeah, setting up the race one way or another, in tilting it toward a certain outcome. How common?
Well, I've not been around races. In my opinion, I have not seen races that have been whose outcomes have been arranged. These guys, jockeys, whether they're veterans, journeymen, or whether they're just apprentices. Most jockeys I know, or virtually all of them I know on the bigger circuits, just ride the hair off a horse and try to win. I don't see, it's very difficult to arrange the outcome of a horse race. Much easier a prize fight where there's a referee in the ring or a basketball game.
And yet everybody's trying to work it one way or another. If they're trying to sort of sell their horse a little short before to make the odds better, if they think they may win, I mean, there are a lot of angles on this that are shy of a fix.
Well, sure. I mean, some trainers will say to a jockey, I want to just give this horse a race. In other words, don't try with him. Some trainers were well known for that years ago. So a first-time starter trained by a certain trainer, for instance, you wouldn't go near him up to the betting windows because you knew the trainer was not going to persevere with him. He was going to tell the jockey, don't be easy on him because I'm going to give him a race. That's been happening since time immemorial, but I'm talking about arranging mm-hmm. the outcome of races.
Mm-hmm.
But, a lot of strategies will involve, just giving a horse a race, building him up to a supreme effort. But on the claiming level, I was talking before about major rates of stake races, but mm-hmm. on the claiming level, horses are, you try with horses virtually every time you run with them. They're in the lower rungs and you really try hard. The big change in my lifetime on the racetrack, when I first came on the racetrack in the 1950s as a groom and a hot walker.
Mm-hmm. What's a hot walker, by the way? Jamie mentions it. You talk about it. What's walking hots?
Walking hots is after a horse works out in the morning or mm-hmm. runs in the afternoon, he's got to be walked for a half an hour or an hour to cool out.
Mm-hmm.
And a hot walker does that. The hot walker in Jamie's novel at the very beginning is an electrical kind that just goes in circuits. It saves the cost of having to pay some guy to walk the horse.
Right.
So they hook him to this machine, and it's sort of, in Jamie's book, it embodies the soul of the racetrack. You go nowhere.
round and round.
Yeah, just around and around and around. When I came on the racetrack, very few horses at the races in the afternoon, in my memory, broke down. Nowadays, horses break down frequently. And I think one of the things that, at least when I was writing about this phenomenon back in the 90s, 1990s,
mm-hmm.
the big change was the use of cortisone to get horses through swollen ankles or bad knees or something. You just inject them with cortisone, the swelling would go down, the pain would go away, and they would run again like they were two-year-olds. But you can only do this so many times before it catches up with you.
Right.
And horses will break down eventually if you keep using that kind of a method.
I want to look at claiming. I want to look at the drug side here. So many callers of Saratoga Springs, speaking of horse country, in New York. Marion, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Marion. What do you know?
Hi, Tom. I also write about horse racing, and I have just a couple of points with which I need to beg to differ. One is that if you've ever seen a thoroughbred or an Arabian foal, even 2 weeks old in a paddock with their mothers, if there are two of them in the field together, they look at each other and they race against each other. The point that we make them race, I tell people that all we do is put a little person on them and tell them to go straight and turn left. But the fact is that they are so competitive, yes, by breeding, but that when they're that young, they will race all day long against each other. And you'll see it borne out in the great ones like Rachel Alexandra, Curlin, Cigar, that when they're in a race, they are acutely aware of the other horses, and they will not be denied. That's partly how Ruffian died, is that she ran herself to death because she would not be denied.
Yeah, Mary, I'm glad for the perspective. Jimmy Gordon, how about it, that natural instinct to go, to do it, to race, to compete, up against what Bill Knack is talking about, horses breaking down and getting in trouble?
The good ones try hard. The really good ones will run like go for one until they drop. or they, you know, they break down. But the, you know, horses, really good racehorses, the best ones will just go and go and go until they don't have anything left. A lot of horses, unfortunately, like human beings, are lazy. And they don't want to go. They're not interested. They get what is called cute on the racetrack, which is, you know, they get to a point where they say, I don't want to do this anymore. And so the races are filled with horses that are either lazy, cute, against horses that really try hard. They're sort of like the human population. There's a lot of different personalities involved here.
Jamie Gordon, what do you say about that range, about the horse?
Well, that's why there are at least two kinds of horses in my book. There are young ones that aren't sore yet, that don't know what's coming. And the racetrackers in my books talk about them as exactly that, being in a way naive about what's going to happen. But the horses that I love and the horses who are kind of the stars in my book are the older ones who would rather run. They maybe sense what comes next for them after their horse racing careers. And in racing at that level, they don't have much of a future after they don't run anymore. But that's not really why they run. They run because they run. They run because once they get out on a track, once they hear that clang, once they have other horses around, that competitiveness overtakes them. That doesn't mean that they themselves don't learn a kind of strategy. I especially like distance horses who, just like human runners, have mm-hmm. to use more of their head than just a willing body to figure out a way to be up front when the finish line comes in sight. But it's those older horses, and there are horses in my book who are 6, 9, and there's one even 12 years old. Who are still willing runners, and they're the money makers in my book. Also, the ones who break your heart really when they can't run anymore for one reason or another.
Jamie Gordon's book is Lord of Misrule, 2010 National Book Award winner. Let's go to Peabody, Massachusetts, and Michael. Hi, Michael. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello. How are you?
Pretty well. What do you know, Michael?
Well, I was listening in, and I'm currently a horse owner now. I have four of my own. And I grew up as a young child in a trailer on a racetrack, mm-hmm. training horses with my family. And it is a tough life. And, you're banking on every win or every place to keep your lights on at night or to give them the right food to make it through to the next the race or through the next month. And it isn't an easy life, and it's not really meant for many people. It is a certain breed that can deal with the elements, deal with the horses, deal with the caliber of people that are on a track. That seems to be, you know, that's what they know, and they travel and they make a life out of it. But it isn't when you're on top. It's a great feeling, and as an adult and as a young child, but. When you're on the bottom, you feel like you'll never get out of it.
Michael, you take us right there, that trailer by the track and horses as the life. I appreciate that call very much. And one more right here from Kentucky, Lexington, Kentucky. Leslie, we've just got a minute, Leslie, but you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I recently published a book about a year inside the country's top hospital for horses in the Kentucky Bluegrass. And what fascinated me was that we have this huge infrastructure here of big farms and insurance agents and large purses. But underneath it all, everyone I met, from small-timers to the famous trainers, was a dreamer, you know, chasing that dream of a big win or wanting to be part of it, especially a win by a dark horse. And I think these racehorses, as well as sport horses in jumping, they tap into a part of us that still believes in magic and is tied through history to horses in a very archetypal way.
Oh, I love it, Leslie. Thank you so much for that. Our time is short, but Jamie,
I
how about it?
I absolutely agree with her.
I love it too.
Who doesn't see it, I guess?
She couldn't have. I couldn't say it better.
But
what my book is all about.
Beautifully
really.
Said.
Yeah, yep. It really was. But what about the ratio here? I mean, there's the dream Is the dream money, Jamie? And if it is, how does that stick up against the smell of the stable and the horse flesh and just the joy of being there?
No, that was the most striking thing to me about being on the track. It wasn't money. It was wanting to get some sort of assurance from the gods that that they liked you especially. Every now and then, I mean, a certain kind of person needs that so badly. And so that kind of person is attracted to an industry where luck is the real currency.
So the horse is kind of the intermediary there to the will of God to let you know how God's feeling about you, whether you're winning or not?
That's right. And when you win, you're sure that you're the darling. And when you lose, you knew you had it coming all along.
Bill, is that the dream? Not necessarily the big purse in the end, but that sort of the word of God through the horse?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with just simply human pride. A lot of the grooms and hot walkers I know are so proud of the horses they work around. They're like children to them. They take a personal interest in them, and when they do well, everybody does well.
You know, it's a whole world and a wonderful world to be in the middle of. Bill Nack, you brought it to us long ago and again through the movie and Secretariat. And we really appreciate your being with us today, Bill. Thanks so much for joining us this
Thank
hour.
You.
And Jamie Gordon, your dark horse win for the National Book Award has got lots of people delighted, and you can just feel all the response to that realm and that world today. It's really a gripping telling. You take us in deep, and we're glad you stayed true to your school, your work racing out there through a long career, Jamie. Thanks for that, and thanks for Lord of Misrule. Thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. You can continue the conversation at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.